Bem-vindos to one more episode of the Type Theory for All podcast. As always, this is your host, Pedro Abreu, and in today's episode, we are going to talk with Nicolas Tabarro, the head of Galinet, one of the main teams which developed the Rock Theorem Prover at INRIA. The original idea of this interview is to talk about the rebranding from Cock to Rock, which is very exciting to our community. However, Nicolas has such a prolific research career that I couldn't miss the opportunity to get him to talk so much more about it. So in this conversation, we talk about his early publications in neuroscience, his views in category theory applied to type theory, Rock's rebranding, and the whole institution around it. We also talk about MetaRock and the conceptual boundaries of certifying a theory within itself. Of course, we also wouldn't miss the opportunity to discuss how Rock feels the growing influence that Lean is gaining in our community. But before we get into that conversation, Dan has a very important message for you guys.
Well, I had this issue with, my loved ones, my parents, my brother, was that they're constantly, I'll be having a very nice conversation with them, but then they'll just do something really embarrassing, like they'll forget the beta reduction rule for the call by name lambda calculus, you know, and it's just like utterly humiliating when that happens. So what I did is I went online and I found this great product online. It's a hat that has the beta reduction rule for the call by name lambda calculus right on it, and also the Type Theory for All logo right there. It's just an incredible tool, and so now nobody ever forgets, and it saves us from lots of embarrassment. I wear this hat everywhere. I wear it to weddings, I wear it to baby showers, I even wore it to a funeral. It's perfect. But you know, Pedro, I can't remember for the life of me where I got this great product from. Do you remember? Do you happen to know?
Yes, you got this from store.typetheoryforall.com. We have a whole branding of shirts, of a really cool hoodie with the lambda cube in the back. We have this awesome beta reduction hat, and we have this really, really cool mug. It's not empty. Has the logo in the front, and in the as a watermark, you have all these cool Greek letters and things like that, which I find amazing. And for the release of this episode, we also got Nicolas to give us the thumbs up to use the logo and have Rock's mug just to celebrate that Rock remaining. Did I say that right? Renaming? Did I say, yeah? Rock, cock. Anyway, so we are really, really happy to celebrate this remaining, and we got it to put it in a mug. Really exciting about it. We have a current 10% off for all products going on. Just use the coupon code Type Theory and get 10% off on all the stuff in the store over there. Welcome, everyone, to one more episode of the Type Theory for All podcast. As always, this is your host, Pedro Abreu, and I'm very, very happy to be here today with my co-host, Dan Plukin. I got your name right once again, and I'm very happy. How are you doing, brother?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm really pleased to be here.
Awesome. And next one is a little harder to say his name, but Nicolas Tabarro. I hope I got that slightly right. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me here.
I am very excited to be doing this conversation today, because I think it's we're going to be talking about something that is quite impactful in our field, in our community. You know, I would say that Cock Rock Theorem Prover is one of the most important tools in programming languages and informal verification that we have. But before we get into the specifics about the branding, the renaming, you know, my listeners usually know that I like to get a little bit on the background of our guest. And I've noticed that you actually started your career working with neuroscientists, Nicolas. Can we talk a little bit, start this conversation talking about, you know, how you got into formal methods, into mathematics, into this early career, until you got to the point where you are working in Rock these days?
Actually, it's not exactly the case that I started as a neuroscientist and then moved to formal method. Actually, I had the chance to do a nice school that exists in France, which is called École Normale Supérieure. And during my studies, I was pushed into trying to investigate different areas of research during internships. And so I did an internship in neuroscience and it went well. But then I decided to do a PhD on my main track, which was computer science and theoretical computer science. And at the same time, I continue collaborating with people at Collège de France on this neuroscientist work. And so I did kind of two PhD at the same time, but I never finished I never defended the PhD on neuroscience, and I just did the one on theoretical computer science, but I never switched subject. I just had some parallel track in my career in the beginning. And then my PhD thesis was more on theoretical computer science, logics and category theory. And then I kind of feel the need of more formal, like exact way of doing proofs, because I was not completely happy about how formal were the proofs in my field. Like I was doing game semantics and this kind of stuff, and I was not entirely convinced by the degree of precision of the proofs. So as many people doing formal methods now, I was pushed into a more exact and computer certified way of doing mathematical proofs, I guess.
So that's when you learned about Calc at the time? How did you get introduced to it?
Yeah, I did an internship at Microsoft Research in Cambridge with Nick Benton. And we were working on certification of compilers. And that's my first Calc proof. So at the time, Calc proof. It was kind of a hard start, because I started doing my first proof on proving the correctness of a compiler, which was quite a thing. But it was a small thing, not as difficult as CompCert, of course, but it was just assembly, simple assembly language. But still, I started using the Calc Proof Assistant on this project, and then keep on working. And I met Mathieu Sozo, which is now the leader of the Rock Prover development team. And we start collaborating together in trying to improve the Calc Proof Assistant at the time. And one step after the other, I get involved more and more in the process.
Did you have a hard time learning to use the Rock Prover when you were starting out?
I'm quite old now, so it was like in the early 2007 or something like that. So at the time, it was already, I was working at Microsoft Research, so my first difficulty was to be able to install Calc on Windows and to get an Emacs working and everything. So I used to use Cygwin and this kind of stuff in order to get some kind of Linux version of Rock on Windows. So this was a hard time installing the thing. But then using it during my studies, I never learned one language. We have always been pushed in kind of having one project, one language. And when we were switching to another project, we had to use another language. So we were already trained in not being focused on one particular language. So I was quite fluent in changing.
So you had actually already used a bunch of theorem proving type of languages already in the past before you started with Rock?
Not really, but I was more into, like, I was able to program in C++, Java, OCaml, Haskell. So it was kind of learning a more complex programming language. But at the time, it was not that hard to learn. It was also less powerful, so fewer things were needed to be understood. And the libraries around were smaller, so it was easier to grab the kind of community context. So now it's more complex to enter, because you need to understand a bigger ecosystem. So that's also at the time we were doing, everyone was doing his own thing on his machine, not really using, I mean, GitHub was not there and collaborative work was not really pushed. So everybody was reinventing the wheel on its side somehow.
I also noticed that, you know, like your research interest seems to be very, very broad, very wide, you know, like doing some linear logic and then category theory and then compiler stuff. And then, you know, like the meta theory of the CIC omega behind the prover and that kind of stuff. How would you define your interest and your, you know, scientific curiosity. What drives you in that sense?
So I definitely have interest in abstract and more theoretical things. So even when I was working on the neuroscience part, I was trying to apply some kind of general theory of control theory about what is called contraction theory, which is a kind of particular way of doing control theory. And it was applying this kind of idea to modeling of basal ganglia and some kind of neural structure in the brain. So it even if it was a bit of practical in the sense that we were modeling something real, it was trying to use a general and abstract idea for abstract theory for this. And so I guess I'm really into this kind of logical, categorical way of seeing my research. But then I try to look at what I find fun, and I don't have a deep introspection of what I consider as fun or not. So it's just the way it is.
I'm really curious if you found any like overlap between that early work in neuroscience and anything later. Was there any like kind of coincidence or just like a single sentence in a paper that happened to be inspired by that work on like a basal ganglia, or nothing?
No. So now I'm trying to start using LLMs and stuff. So it's kind of neural based as well. So the full connection circle may be there, but.
Okay. Very interesting, actually. Given that, so maybe you're more equipped of a guest than most of our guests to talk about like LLMs and thinkingness and logic. I don't know. Do you have any kind of thoughts on that? Or do you have any kind of work that you've been doing very recently that you could talk about the LLMs?
Yeah, so we are starting to do some investigation of how to use LLMs for theorem proving. Well, we are not the only one, but so as experts of the field of theorem proving, we try to be on another line than the people from AI trying to do theorem proving. So they are trying to do automatic proof out of thin air. Here we are more trying to define right truths in order to decrease the boilerplate for users of theorem provers. And one of the main, so maybe it brings us to another discussion, but one of the main interests for me of using LLMs will be translation between theorem provers. So for example, porting MATLIB into the rock prover, or porting MATCOMP, which is developed inside the rock prover, into MATLIB. So having some bridges between the theorem provers, because it's kind of frustrating now. So they are more and more used, and they have still significant differences, even if they are quite similar. And when you start working with one library, you're kind of forced to use one prover, and then it's very hard to put a bridge to another one. So people relying on Comcert or CertiRock or whatever, they're kind of forced to use the rock prover, and people relying on big libraries in MATLIB, then they're forced to use LIN. And it's kind of a shame that currently in 2025, we still have to use the one tool because of its libraries and not because of the tool itself. And so we're trying to use LLMs to facilitate this translation. And for the moment, we have been using LLMs to translate from rock to rock by taking a proof written in what we used to call vanilla rock, or like typical LTAC, basic LTAC 1 tactics, like all style proofs, and porting it into a MATCOMP SS reflex style proof. So it's a bit technical maybe, but two different kind of doing proofs. So even if it's inside the same theorem prover, the different ways of doing proofs, and they can be considered as almost different languages, because one user will write the proof in one style and other libraries will use a different style, and it's almost a different language. And so we are using LLMs to translate like a linter that will automatically produce the valid SS reflex type proof. For example, if you have a user that wants to contribute to MATCOM but it doesn't write the proofs in the right style, then the linter will automatically provide the like kind of clean the pull request and make it MATCOM compliant for free. And you can learn also how to use the new style by you write your proof, you see what it does. And then you use the LLM translator to put it into the SS reflex style and say, ah, yeah, okay, I should have written it this way. And then it can be also a way to learn without kind of jumping to a new world directly, but by kind of learning the translation with what you already know.
I would be very curious to see that at works, because I've done some work translating proofs between different, you know, like, but then I'm talking about not the tactic proofs, but the actual term behind, right? And that's well typed and all of that. But when you're translating the tactics itself, it's kind of much harder in many ways, right? Because you kind of like miss the underlying context of the type of
stuff.
But
the thing is that that's why we use LLMs.
Like right.
We just use the kind of we use the LLM from this DeepSeek, the Queen Solid 2 Babel 1, and we just try to learn the decompilation thing. So we learn the tactics.
That's why exactly I would be very curious to see how well it works, because in my mind is like, this is a very hard problem. So I'm very curious how LLM would do, how well
it's not even play. Hard. It's even not well defined somehow.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
from a symbolic point of view, we cannot even define what it should do. But from a neural point of view, it's just trying to get like the most probable connection between the input and the output, and to reverse the translation. And it works well for compiler for example, from C to assembly code. Mm-hmm. LLMs are able to generate the C code that will produce some particular assembly code, or be as close as possible from this assembly code. And the reverse, that decompilation from assembly to C looks like also a kind of even not non-well defined problem, because there may be some assembly code that doesn't come from any C code, and but still LLMs are quite good at doing this by magic. I mean, I don't have any explanation for this.
Yeah, exactly. It's very exciting, actually, and especially once we are able to kind of have some other tool that will double check if things are making sense on somehow, you know, like actually maybe comparing some semantics, maybe, you know, like just making sure that not only sitting down as a human being and this makes sense, but some verification that it's compliant somehow. That would be very exciting.
Yeah. Right? Here we have verification for free, because once we have the new proof, we can just evaluate it and get the new proof term and check that it proves the same theorem. So it's correct by construction. So
well, but then you also have to show that this both semantics match, right?
We are proving the same theorem, so it's just a new proof of the same theorem. So this is the easy
right.
part of the of the check. What is difficult is when you want to translate from lint to rock,
different language,
because then you need to make sure that the statement align as well and everything. So this we are not there yet, unfortunately, but maybe at some point.
Well, you're in a really enviable position, because you have this, you know, certified, you have this proof checker that will just make sure that you can't write any incorrect programs. And, you know, it feels like every day, every week, I'm seeing an article like against vibe coding. Is there any plan to make like a web development framework in Coq so that people can vibe code their web apps? It's really just a joke answer. It's just a joke question. Don't cut this out.
Or be using LLMs in the future. Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
I think it's actually, we have some very interesting ways to go about LLMs. And in fact, half of the website for this podcast, I vibe coded. So I'm all in for vibe coding. I don't know any of TypeScript and any of that, but and it works extremely well. I think it's actually very exciting. But anyways, another thing that I'm curious is, okay, so the title that you have on your website, Nicolas, is that you're the research head of Galinet. I'm curious to ask, you know, like what does that actually entail, and what does it mean to be inside the Coq development team, and how the team works itself, you know, like have some better understanding of the institution behind the rock prover.
Yeah, so the maybe the situation in France is a bit particular compared to what could be seen in the US or even everywhere in other countries in Europe. But so here we have some kind of overlap between the the structure of my institution which is in RIA, which is part of the main institution behind the work program. But the research team that I lead, that the Galina team, is a research team of Inoya, but it's not entirely not everybody in my research team is working on the development of the work program. It just happened to be the case that more than half of the team is working on the development of the work program, but it can even not be their own subject of interest, and they are doing research on other things. So we are not forced to work on it, but we just dedicate some time to work on it. So there is some kind of overlap between the research team and the work development team, but there are other teams at Inoya also working on this. And we also welcome a contribution from user outside Inoya, of course. And because the work program is on GitHub and it's open source and everything, anybody in principle can contribute to it. But in practice, it's true that maybe like 2/3 of the work development team is made of Inoya researcher, but there are also other people involved in this. And as the head of Galinet, I'm not technically the head of the work development team, because it's Mathieu Sozo who is the leader of the team, and Mathieu happens to be in my team, but it's kind of intricated, but orthogonal at the same time.
I think I was a little rude to not ask him to be here as well. Please send him my apologies. I thought about it, but I was a little, you know, like trying to coordinate things. So. So what exactly is the research head of Galinet then?
So the head of NERIA research team is just trying to organize a bit the work and to make the collaboration inside the team happening. But every permanent researcher in the team has its own liberty to do whatever he wants. And we're trying, I mean, of course, every people in the team are working on connected subject. But for instance, maybe you know Asya Mabubi also in the team. Mm-hmm. She's running an ERC project on a certification of algebra software stuff in Rock. So she's an expert user of the Rock program. She has been doing a proof with Georges Gontier about Fane Thompson and everything, but she's not technically involved in the development of the work program itself. But it's very good also to have this kind of people in the same team, because they can give a very nice and precise feedback on the use of the tool, and the feedback on can have an impact, because we do modify the tool to improve it. Mm-hmm. With respect to it, so it's a nice synergy inside the team, even if we are not working exactly on the same subject. And as a head of the team, I take care of hiring new permanent and trying to hire new permanent and to make the team bigger. But
and also the PhD students, I suppose.
And we do have PhD students, but each PhD student is supervised by a permanent member of the team. So for some of them, I'm not even involved in the supervision. I just make sure that everything goes well, but I'm not involved in the scientific direction sometimes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
you do have postdoc as well, but
yeah. And how do you guys prioritize what should be implemented or worked on in the rock prover?
So before, it was more a matter of a developer wants to do something and the other one agree that it's an interesting thing and the thing is done. So it was based on the hobby of each researcher, because we the particular situation, so that's not the case for the Lean FRO structure, where they are hired ready to work on work. On Lean and for the rock developer. So now we have few engineer working on the full time on the project. So the first one hired used to be Maxime Dennis, but he now left. But now we have Gaëtan Gilbert and Romain Tetley and the new one that are hired as a full time engineer. So, but there are only three of them, and all the other developers, they do the work on more or less on their free time. Oh, no, it's not free time, but they manage to get times out of their research time to do this. And because of that, it's hard to force them to do one particular thing, because they are not even, I mean, they're not under my hierarchy or whatever. So we have no pressure on them. So we just let them do what they think is important. But now we try to change a bit the system, because the work program is starting to be more used, and we kind of, it's more than it's a bit more than a prototype and a kind of research tool. It's becoming a real tool used in the industry and so on. So we have more responsibilities about how it evolves and does it go to the right direction. So we are trying to. So we have something called the Work Consortium, where we have kind of members from the industry that pay some fees every year to be member of this consortium, so that we can hire engineers and stuff. And we try to give them a way to kind of not decide what to do, but at least if because we don't have time to do everything, if we propose like 10 potential stuff that can be implemented in the coming years or 2 years, they can decide which one to prioritize among the other. And then you try to make sure that people will do the work. So, but this is changing. Like 5 years or 10 years ago, it was not really like this, and we are trying to make the development a bit more professional, let's say.
Uh-huh. Actually, it's kind of really surprises me how a tool like this got so much traction and so big, and it's basically, in a way, it's just like this research endeavor out of that triggers the curiosity and the interest of many different people that just decides to spend their time working on this. And a lot of the tests that you're going to have to do in a language, not only a language, like a prover, interactive prover like this, is you're not going to, a lot of the work is not publishable. It's, you know, like just engineering effort and engineering tests and extremely hard engineering effort that, you know, like this people gets just excited to sit down and work on this. So in that sense, it surprises me how big it could get, you know, like how much interest it could get. And it tells me something about the depth of what is being done here. You know, like the there's something kind of like, almost feel as if it's touching something fundamental of doing proving, doing computer science and doing math, right? And this actually triggered my next question. You know, like there is, what are your thoughts? Like you've thought, I'm sure you thought a lot about this, you know, like working on the type theory, on the fundamentals behind all of that, especially nowadays. I've seen that there's a lot of work being done on, you know, like the universe polymorphism side of this stuff, which is extremely complicated and hard to get right. What do you think are the kind of like conceptual limits of the current type theory of the rock theorem prover?
Yeah, so thanks for the question. The type theory of the rock theorem prover and the one of Lin, for example, if I can try to talk about both of them at the same time, because they are very close. Somehow the Lin type theory is just some kind of copy of the one implemented in work with some minor modification, but this minor modification may not be as minor as that from a usability point of view. So one thing is maybe we're still lacking a very good notion of equality in theorem, in proof of systems in general. So Lin made some choices, going to an undecidable type checking, but having an equality which support quotient and many actions such as functional exponentiality. In work, the situation currently is more like relying on a less powerful equality, but more control. And then you have cubicle like that, trying to use a univalent equality and everything. And so the situation with equality is still a bit unclear in type theory. And for example, you should not be forced to use one system if you want one particular feature of your equality. It's a bit weird to be forced to use cubicle like that. If you want a bit of univalence, it should be kind of maybe with more or less convenient, but you should be able to use it in work as well and in lean. And so that's why I'm working on more foundational work on salt polymorphism in order to be able to have multiple type theory inside a single proof assistant. So the situation before was like what we were trying to define the best type theory in which to do the foundational system for, like, to replace set theory somehow with the best foundational system. And my point of view on this is now we should not try to get only one, but to accept a variety of foundational system that share the main principle of what is called Martin Neuf type theory, but as a common framework with differences that can be like the polymorphism is a way to kind of define generic notion that should work in any case. But then you could have like univalence or the fact that you have UI uniqueness of identity proofs and quotient in other ways. And so there should be just some kind of specific part of your type theory, but using this, you should not be forced to use a world proof assistant and move to another one. That's my point of view. There is no reason for not having everything work together. The main reason why we were afraid about that is that we know that there are some inconsistencies that can come if you postulate axioms that are incompatible. So that was really frightening from a logical point of view. But now we have a way using this salt polymorphism thing to kind of prevent the axioms to interact with each other. And so we can accept different axioms without hitting the inconsistency issue. So we can now be more liberal in the which kind of axiomatic we can accept inside in the system, because they can even be incompatible, but we can control this incompatibility.
This is actually a question that shows up in that translation we were talking earlier with the LLMs between theorem provers kind of thing. Because if in one of your provers you have an axiom that is incompatible with the other prover, then everything is like... In practice, maybe it's not over, but you know, like in the long term, like you're actually might be doing something that is not actually provable in the other one, right? So
yeah, but with this sort the ability to have different universes there, we can use this to say, okay, I translate into the lean proof assistant into the work prover by using a specific universe for lean. And this one has a proof irrelevance and quotient and everything, and even excluded middle if you want. But you can still get cubic OLAGDA and still translate it into the work prover, but in the AGDA sort or cubic OLAGDA sort. And then you control the interaction between the lean and cubic OLAGDA sort in order not to get a trivial inconsistency by using axioms that are incompatible together. So that they can live inside the same system, but you have a frontier and you can control the frontier.
That is so exciting. I think this is a very, very interesting research topic. That there's so many questions. There are so many ways to go about this. There is the side of the tools. There is the side of the theory. There is the side of the universes. There is this stratification. There's a lot going on there. This thing's pretty cool. Dan, you seem like you're thinking very hard there.
I'm always, you know, trying to follow along with all the like cool stuff that you guys are talking about. I think I'm like, it sounds like a dream. The idea that you can, you're talking about the idea that like maybe I, for a particular proof, I need to rely on some kind of like cubical AGDA properties or some kind of cubical properties. And you're saying that I can kind of, like maybe there's some kind of library that relies on kind of univalence as an assumption. You're saying that I can use that library without even assuming univalence myself using the sort polymorphism. Am I understanding that correctly?
Not exactly. Is that you can restrict the setting in which you rely on univalence only in the proof of your lemma, for example. And if your lemma in the end you're proving, so what is a very famous proof is called the Brownian number, which is some kind of homotopy group of the sphere, and the Brownian number is 2. So it's famous because it's just 2, but the proof that it is equal to 2 has been very big. So that's why it's famous. But once you know it's 2, then 2 is a valid number also in the sort of lean. So you can use the result of your lemma without you relying on univalence at all, because 2 exists whatever universe is. So the fact that two is the right homotopy, is the right number corresponding to the homotopy group of the sphere, like Z to NZ, this relies on univalence. But then you can separate the fact that then you can manipulate the integer itself using UIP and excluded middle and whatever to do something else with it. And the fact that you have proven some property on it using univalence is completely disconnected from the fact that you will be using it for computing some exponential or whatever. So this is where the you still rely on univalence to prove some univalent properties. But once you get an observable result like a Boolean or a natural number, you can modularly encapsulate the way that this number has been produced by some crazy theory, but I can use it in some other crazy theory to do something else as a result of a computation.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I was done.
Okay. So we've kind of talked around sort polymorphism, but do you think you could like kind of give a summary of what exactly the technique is?
So it's very easy. It's very similar to Prenex polymorphism that you have in ML. So when you do definition of a list, most of the time you don't really care about what is inside the list. You're just using the structure, and the Prenex quantification gives you for any alpha, and an alpha is an arbitrary type. You can concatenate an element of alpha with a list of alpha, and you get a new list of alpha. So this alpha thing is a polymorphic quantification, saying that you're just relying on the structure of the list, but not what is inside the list itself. Mm. And you're manipulating some kind of algebraic key your list. Mm. And here we introduce similar notion of polymorphism and quantification, saying that I'm working with some universe, so what is in lin you have type and prop, in rock you have type, s prop and prop, and you can expect, so we have been defining with Pierre-Marie-Pedro what we call an exceptional theory, type theory, in which you have a universe where you can raise exception in type, so every type is inhabited with an exception, which is very convenient from a programming point of view, but very bad from a logical point of view, because then false can be inhabited easily. But this is okay as long as you kind of control this, and then you can do definitions that does not really rely on the fact that you're doing stuff for prop, for type, or for s-prop, and you get a generic definition. So, for example, the concatenation of two types is independent from the nature of the types, the product of two types. So if you take A star B, if A and B are type, you can do it. If they're proposition, it's usually called conjunction, but it's still just the product of the two things. And in s-prop, you have as well conjunction. So what happens is that in lin or in the rock program, you have a lot of duplication of definition depending on whether you use type, proposition, strict proposition, and everything. But they are all relying on the same dependent type theoretic mechanism. And so what we are doing is we are providing abstraction to be quantifying over for any universe. I don't really use the specificity of this universe. I just manipulate it abstractly somehow. And here we have generic definition, and even list can be defined over proposition and types as well. And then you just instantiate with the particular universe you want to work with when you want to use a concrete instantiation of the definition. Mm-hmm. Maybe that easy to explain.
No, I got it. The only part that I didn't get was at the start was the prenex polymorphism. I hadn't heard that specific term.
So it's particular kind of where you cannot quantify it everywhere. So you cannot quantify anywhere in your type. It's always only at the top. So for example, in ML, you have for alpha, beta, whatever, and then a type. But you cannot interleave functions and stuff with prenex quantification. It's always at the beginning. So you somehow you provide all the type variable that you need, and then you describe your type. But you cannot, in the middle of the description of your type, start quantifying over a new type variable when you want. Mm-hmm. It's a restricted form of quantification.
Gotcha. And I saw that you've been working also on like observational equality for Koch. And that's like another one of those kinds of models of equality, in addition to something like what lean has, in addition to univalence. It's one of those things that
Yeah, so it's not in addition to what Lean has. It's another solution to what Lean is doing. So it's trying to get the same properties, like uniqueness of identity proofs and proof relevance, quotient types, functional extensionality, but without going to undecidable type checking. So what does undecidable type checking means? That it means that when you have finished your proof, you have the danger that maybe the system will not be able to check your proof, even if it's a valid proof. You have a correct checker, but not complete. It may say, maybe it's a good proof, but I'm not able to say it. And if you have done a big proof, it can be very frustrating to end up finishing with the system telling you, I will not be able to timestamp your proof, do another one. Or maybe you will never be able to do any one. So there is no guarantee on the fact that any proof will be valid or rejected. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do also, it's continuing the work of Conor McBride in the 90s, but we are trying to kind of make it a bit more concrete and modern. And so we are in the process of implementing it in the work prover in order to get the same properties as as Lean equality without giving up on decidability of type checking, which is at least to the work prover development in a very crucial property.
It's interesting that you talk about decidability because, I mean, like, couldn't Coq, like, even if it has a decidable type checking, like, I mean, is it in practice, it's always also fast? You know, we talk about decidability, undecidability, but...
Yeah, so it's good. That's one of the canonical arguments against justifying the no need for decidability from Lean users and from other users. They say, yeah, but in practice, if it's very long to say yes, it's the same as not being able to say yes. But so it's at the same time, it's very different from a conceptual point of view because you know that the system should be able to respond. So you have ways to do it, which is by controlling a bit the reduction and so on. It's not a theoretical limitation. And in practice, it seems very unlikely that you really hit a strong problem with, if you can already hit problem with efficiency, but it's more like when you are evaluating a very big natural number or this kind of thing. It's not because you're doing a logical proof that is a bit complex. The most of the time, the complexity comes from evaluation and stuff like that, which are quite orthogonal. So even if it's true that it's not because you're decidable that you will be efficient and usable in practice, to us it's the first brick that without that you have even less guarantee. But it's not sufficient. You need to be fast enough because many algorithms that we use are exponential or this kind of stuff, and we know that in practice exponential is not. Doesn't scale, so we need to find heuristics to make it a bit better.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I wouldn't use that kind of discrepancy to say, therefore, we should go to undecidable checking. I would say, therefore, we really need decidable checking, not only decidable, but fast type checking. And it just happens to be that we don't really have great language in computer science still for being able to talk about something being fast in general, in addition to being decidable. I don't know. But that's just kind of an interesting thing that's always bothered me in computer science is that we talk about decidability, but we really mean fast most of the time, I guess, something like that. Yeah.
And then problem of decidability of the type checking also shows up not only in the final response, but also, because it's undecidable, you need to do some compromise and you need sometimes to do some shortcut. And then as a user, you end up applying a tactics that makes your new goal not even typable. You had a previous goal, you applied a tactic, and the new goal becomes untypeable because the type checker is not able to type it. And so it's kind of a weird feeling when doing proofs that you're doing legal stuff and the type checker rejects it. So it's a bit in the control flow of your proof, it's a bit of theorem proving as a user. It's a bit annoying.
Mm-hmm. I think this brings an interesting conundrum between the theory and the engineering behind the proof assistant, right? Because this part where you want things to be fast and to, you know, like do not take years to compute, but also you want things to be decidable. And it seems to me that for Coq development, rock development, you want to make sure a priori, at first, that the theory is correct, that things will be right from first principles, and then you figure out how to engineer that. Is this a fair assessment?
Because yeah, we're trying to work this way.
Okay, okay. Because I have a feeling, I might be wrong, might have to ask Leo or someone, but I have a feeling that lean is usually a little bit on the other way around. They want things to be, you know, like engineering extremely good, and you know, like lean first, things were implemented using C++ with this extremely fast background, and then you mesh the theory to make sure that things are correct. That's kind of like the feeling that it gives me, right? So it's kind of like this dichotomy.
That's a great feeling, I would say.
Between these two approaches, right? So yeah, and also, so now that we're talking about, you know, like the theory behind, I must ask about MetaCoq. How far are we from fully verifying Coq's kernel inside of itself?
So it's called MetaRock now.
Okay,
it has been renamed as well.
Nice.
So we have finished the first pass. So it's a bit technical, but what has not been formalized for the moment is the module system of the work prover.
Oh, that's a hard one, right?
And it's also because it's not even entirely clear what has been implemented.
Okay.
One of the purposes of the module system was developed at the same time as the COMSAT compiler. Mm-hmm. And so it was also to get a module system that can be extracted quite faithfully to the module system of OCaml.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow there are some kind of deep incompatibilities between the module system on the Serum Prover side and on the general programming language side. So we're trying to make compatible stuff that are kind of inherently a bit incompatible. So that's why this module system is not very principled. And the first step to formalize it would be to specify it. Mm-hmm. And we are not quite sure what to specify exactly. And the other properties that have not been, the other main property that is missing, maybe the only one, is extensional rules for conversion. So we don't have extensionality for function, and we don't have a formalization of proofier relevance yet, like definitional proofier relevance of S-prop. And this is because what has been formalized at the time of MetaCoq is an untyped conversion. So the type system is typed, but once we compare two terms, we forget about the type and we do the kind of syntactic comparison by evaluating, reducing the term and comparing their normal form somehow. And this is untyped. And the problem is that if you want to talk about extensional rule, you need to know about the type, because functional extensionality relies on the fact that you're comparing terms at a function type. And proofier relevance relies on the fact that you're comparing proofs that lives in property in S-prop or prop for lean. So we need some type information during the conversion for the extensional part of the rule, at least to have a nice theory. And so we realize that we need to modify the whole MetaRock thing in order to start from a typed conversion and not an untyped conversion as we did. And this is a lot of work, because then it makes typing system and conversion being mutually defined. And it makes a lot of the development of the theory harder because of this kind of loop between definition of the type system and of the conversion. So before, we were able to define all the theory of conversion and then work on the type system that was relying on the conversion. But when conversion only works on well-typed term, then you need to do the meta theory of everything all together, and it's much more intricated. So I don't know if you ever try to formalize stuff with mutual inductive type, but it's much harder in practice than doing on one type first and then finish on the other one. So it's more a technical problem than a theoretical problem, but we are still in this process. But apart from that, it's pretty much the whole theory has been implemented.
I think every time that I stumble upon MetaCoq, MetaRock, I think about this and I ask this question, and sometimes people will give an answer and be like, yeah, this is fine. and it's not entirely clear to me. Maybe you can give me an easy answer this time. But the idea of implementing, of proving something correct inside itself seems to stumble upon Godot's incompleteness theorem kind of thing, right? So why does Metal Rock does not stumble upon, you know, like, why can you specify and prove its correctness inside its own language? Like, what is the trick here?
So there is a big trick for they can have several tricks, but we use a big trick is that the thing that I have not been mentioning that we don't formalize is strong normalization of reduction. So we assume that the specification of the system guarantees the fact that any well type term have a normal form.
Right.
And then assuming this, we prove that we have a correct and complete type checker for this specification of the theory. So assuming that the theory is correct, in the sense that we don't accept a non-terminating term, we prove correctness of the whole type checker thing. So we kind of implement the theory, but we assume that it is correct. And proving a strong normalization, this is where we need to go to a higher or a bigger type theory. Mm-hmm. The only thing that you cannot justify yourself is your own consistency. But assuming that your theory is valid, then you can prove inside the theory that you have a correct implementation of it. So it's not exactly we are not formalizing the theory itself. We are formalizing the implementation of the type checking of the theory.
Right.
And somehow the fact that we implement a good type theory is more a matter of belief. Because there is no such thing as a proof of consistency. There is a proof of equiconsistency. You assuming that some abstract meta theory is valid, I can prove that this theory that I'm looking at is also valid. But in the end, you're still relying on something else.
Right, yes.
So there is no big point. You can just say, oh, I like this theory. That's my church.
It's been working for 40 years. I might as well accept that it's correct, right?
No, but on this line, one fun story that maybe not that many people know is that the first version of Matin-Löf type theory by Per Matin-Löf was using type in type, which is inconsistent. But Matin-Löf's proof was correct. So he did a correct proof on his system, but the system is inconsistent. How could it be the case? Actually, he was relying on an inconsistent system as a meta theory to do the proof. But the proof was correct. But then it was not showing much because the inconsistency was already in the meta theory.
Okay.
So this is not saying that there is no point in doing a proof of consistency using meta theory and so on. I'm just saying that at some point you still to rely on something else, and the consistency is some kind of God-given stuff. I mean, you will never be able to fully fully formalize it, but we can formalize the implementation, which is much more error prone than the theory itself.
Right. Yeah,
and so that's what the story we talk about in our meta work paper is that every year we have several inconsistency in the work program. All of them comes from bug in implementation. Not the type theory has not changed. It's just that it was incorrectly implemented on some corner cases, of course.
So has the MetaRock project led to any kind of discoveries of problems with the implementation? Would that even make sense?
Yeah. We did. So it was not an inconsistency proof, but we realized that the kind of representation of pattern matching was incorrect. And what was failing was not consistency, but subject reduction. So the fact that when you reduce a term that has type A, the reduced term still has the same type, so it's called progress in progress and preservation in more traditional programming languages, type programming. And so this property was failing because of the representation of the way we were representing pattern matching, and so we had to change even in Coq at the time. So there have been a pull request in Coq first to modify the representation, and then we have been able to formalize the new version in MetaCoq. But the bug was found by trying to formalize the previous version implemented in Coq, and that was not correct.
Okay, because one thing that I was thinking was like that, you know, we have the existing implementation of the kernel of Coq, of ROC, and then we have this completely separate verified implementation, and that those two things, I mean, you can prove that this thing the latter thing is correct, but that doesn't really tell you anything about the original implementation. But because you're actually formalizing the original implementation, you're able to kind of backtrack and realize that you've made some kind of mistakes.
Yeah, so there are two ways of seeing it. So first, yeah, we exactly use the same representation of term and everything as in DML. So ML and OCaml and ROC share the very common syntax for inductive types and what is called absolute data type in OCaml, but or generalized absolute data type stuff. So it's very easy to have a perfect match between the very syntactic representation of the kernel in both systems. And then one ideal goal would be to be able to use the meta ROC type checker as a final checker. So when you're doing your proof, you need a very fast one because you need it to fail and to go quick during the development. But once the proof has been done, like your library is fixed, then you can spend 20 hours instead of two waiting for everything to compile, because you would do it only once. It's done.
Imagine finding a mistake there.
Pretty not. But what is not reasonable is to use the formalized type checker as a daily base with the tactic system and everything. But as a final certifier for, like, let's say some kind of security agency requires a very strong guarantee on your proof, then you can say, okay, it has been even type checked with the very annoying one.
But with MetaRock done, we finally, like, there's always seems to be like more questions about, like, we're anxious about our type system. Will we finally be done proving consistency of your equal consistency of ROC? Will we finally just be able to relax and write proofs, or will there be more kind of meta ROC or whatever?
No, I think from traditional mathematics and computer science point of view, they're already quite relaxed. I mean, people using lint for Matlib don't really care about eventual corner cases inconsistency that can be found. In the end, all the proof of inconsistency that has been done by finding a bug and then trying to exploit the bug with expert user and trick the system. You never hit the bug by mistake, I mean by chance, non chance. So I think the people concerned in this kind of meta things justification are logicians as we are, but people using it, they don't really. They want the system to say yes to their proof, and they are happy. They don't really care about this kind of thing.
Yeah, I've definitely had that experience. But I mean, like, will logicians finally be satisfied with the consistency of ROC? Do you think, or will there be?
No, because from a logician point of view, what matters is the kind of consistency correctness of the theory, not of its implementation. So what we guarantee is more the. Of course, we have more and more.
I see. I mean,
even if it's just equiconsistency, you're explaining how it works even more. But still, the fact that Permatinov, which was a very nice and rigorous logician, managed to do a correct proof of an inconsistent system is still a bit of annoying.
Yeah,
I don't know
what
to say. And Gödel's incompleteness theorem some kind of tell us that we are forced to live with it somehow. But
I really appreciate your saying that there's no such thing as consistency. There's just equiconsistency, because that's been so confusing to me learning. I'm like, why are people still talking about proving consistency? But that makes so much more sense that you can only prove it with another formal system. And that's really what you're doing. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
There is there is another theorem by Tarski that is a little less talked about, where it shows exactly that in order for you to prove, it's like the next step of Gödel incompleteness, right? To prove the consistency of a language, you need a higher, kind of like a higher language, like the meta language. And to prove the consistency of this meta language, you need to go higher. So there is this hierarchy of languages that you're never, it's impossible to reach the top, right? You're always relying on language that is above. So this is what Nikola is is saying that you're always relying on this other language, right? This meta language, this higher language. That's a theorem as well.
Yeah, but the thing in type theory is that it's even more tricky because somehow you can prove consistency of Martinov type theory with some amount of universes, let's say five, so we have a proof with my former student Loïc Puget that you only need four additional universes. But so if you want to n, you need n plus four.
Okay.
But somehow it's almost the same theory because right. Once you're abstracting over the number of you still rely on a bigger one,
exactly.
But you don't really care about how many levels do you need. And in the end, it looks like you can take the limit and say, okay, I have formalized all of them, but not really because you always need a bit more universes. Yeah. But somehow it's making Gödel incompleteness a bit less frightening because you're just saying, I'm justifying one system using the other one with the same system somehow. It's up to some level of universes, the same system. So yeah. I think the question becomes more philosophical than technical, yes, at some point.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember when I was interning at NICTA at the time, it's Data 61 these days. So like people who are working on CL4 and things like that. And you know, like me being this young, naive researcher that is just getting used to all of this super formalization stuff, you got really excited. Oh, we're going to have 100% guarantee of the correctness of our stuff. And you always start getting into this point of, okay, but what of this other thing? What of this other little thing here? And what I was thought at that time, and I brought it with me, is that, dude, in the end of the day, you're always going to be relying on your hardware to work at any point. You know, like you can always have this quantum bit that would just flip randomly, and like you have to trust that something works in the end of the day, right?
Yeah, you have interaction with the real world. So.
Right, exactly. But you know, like having these extra layers of guarantees and these extra layers of correctness is always interesting to kind of like give us an extra layer of confidence for ourselves to be talking about this stuff. And it's, in the end of the day, the important thing, you know, like for the industry, the important thing is that we are actually reducing the amount of bugs that is gonna get out in the wild, right? So it's always a nice thing. But does it pay, you know, like for the industry perspective, does it pay to go all down this way? Probably not. So yeah, anyways. One thing that I wanted to ask earlier is when you started saying about your research career and how you've done category theory. One thing that I've noticed, in especially you know like doing part of my PhD in the US, is that you know in programming languages and formal verification, sometimes it's kind of almost like a taboo to talk too much about category theory. A lot of you know like functional programmers think that category theory is you know like We're going too far, and we don't need to deal with all of that. What is your perspective? How much category theory can assist our intuition and our thought on implementing type theories, or you know, like doing type theory in general?
So depends on what we mean by category theory exactly, but the notions that sometimes exist before category theory, but that has been generalized and explained a bit nicely in category theory, such as sheaves and pre-sheaves and this kind of stuff. They are very useful and used in model of type theory. And so there is an interaction here using construction that comes from other branches of mathematics that can be abstracted using category theory that we can reuse to define models of our systems. And it would have been very difficult to get the right notions and the right intuition on things without this interaction with traditional mathematics and the abstraction layer provided by category theory. So to me, category theory is more like an abstract tool in order to provide connection between fields, different mathematical fields that can look disconnected without this abstraction. So it's not a tool on its own. It's more a common language like the Esperanto of algebraic structures, and thanks to that we have been able to develop complex model and still work even the work on univalence and cubical type theory has been made possible mainly thanks to the connection with homotopy theoretic models of cubical and simplicial sets and the categorical abstraction over it in order to connect it more nicely to the syntax of cubical type theory. And not just talking about topological spaces, because at some points we need to talk about lambda terms and not topological spaces. So we need some kind of abstraction in between. And that's the right, for me, that's what one of the right way of using category theory. But I'm not doing category theory on its own. No, not anymore, at least.
It reminds me of when somebody asked Geoffrey Hinton how he pictures like working with n-dimensional spaces. He said, what you do is how to visualize it. He says, just visualize a three-dimensional space and then say n-dimensional very loudly. So I wonder if, like, when you guys are doing, people who work a lot in category theory, I wonder if you are really working at the category level or if you're really thinking about a concrete example and you're just saying category theory really loudly in your head.
Yes, I think here the people that are defining new notions based on geometric intuition and this kind of stuff, they are doing this. But then what is nice is that it can be reused by people that don't even understand the original examples that were used to provide this abstraction. So this is where the magic of category theory appears. That you can reuse the structure even without understanding anything about the mathematical object that gave rise to this abstraction.
But I don't understand category theory, so
no, you don't really understand it. It's just you're able to map it to the new things that you want to rely on, yeah. Like the structure that interests you, and you don't understand why this notion exists. But you do a new mapping. Yeah, that's what you're saying. You're saying category theory loudly, but on your own stuff.
Yeah. So I get to think about my particular Cartesian Clause category, and you get to think about yours, but we speak the common language of whatever is the actual category.
At least we have the feeling of speaking the same language, I know.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes when you go to detail, you realize that it's not exactly the case. But...
Okay, I think we can go ahead and let's talk about the renaming. So what was the background of the backstages of how the rebranding worked out? Was it some sort of peer pressure from the community? Was it something that came from the inside? What was the intricacies there?
So it's not really background because everything has been made as public as possible. But I would not say peer pressure, but it was a kind of... request from the community. At least they put to our attention that it was starting to be more and more difficult for English speaking countries to use this terminology in daily work and when teaching or when talking to other people about your work. And the fact that it can affect that much so some people was really of importance to us. So that's why we start thinking about changing the renaming thing. So it was not an easy choice because after 40 years, of course, the name has been very deeply integrated into everybody's mind. And also the name was nice for others' perspective because coq was the name of a French animal, which is a symbol of France. It's the beginning of Thierry Coquin, and he was the inventor with Gérard Huet of the tools. And it's also the initials of calculus of construction. So it many stuff were that the name was clever in some sense, and for other way of seeing it, it was not clever. So.
I must say that difficult. from the French perspective is also a very very interesting joke, like for the behind the English speakers to be like, okay, now we pronounce coq for this. That's also another layer that I find amusing, although it got too big to be a joke these days. But I mean, I appreciate that.
Yeah, it seems that the joke that could have been done in some part of the time cannot be done in some other
right.
future part of the time as well. And the fact that we decided to move was mainly also because maybe also we want to show that we're trying to go to a more professional and less kind of research and only to academics tools and making it a new life as a real prof assistant that can be used in industry and so on. So it was a way to renew a bit everything.
And, Lean showing up on the scene kind of spur you guys to change the direction for Rock in that way? Or was that kind of all? No, for the kind, well, you've talked a lot about kind of trying to bring Rock into kind of more mainstream. And I wonder, you know, what has driven that decision? Is it just a kind of natural phenomenon of having lots of industrial users? Or is it also kind of more of the competition that has kind of
At least up to now, the competition with Lean is not really a competition. It's more like Lean has been able to kind of concentrate the new mathematical community, trying to make use of indirect least for improving for formalizing mathematics. And this part of the community we missed with the work program. But the part of the community that is doing formalization of computer scientific or programming languages and so on, from the beginning they are using the work program. And now the fact that it's very hard to switch, I was explaining about LLM stuff, to switch from one program to another makes that naturally we still have a very strong community, and even WebAssembly has been formalized in work and so on. So we have more and more users here, and I think that's more on this line. All the people using the work prover for their industrial application, that we kind of feel some kind of responsibility to them in order not to make their project takes 100 times slower to compile and so on. So we really need to. At the same time, we need to make the system evolve, but we need to make it in a way that we don't break what was already achieved. So it's a lot of work, but it's a lot of responsibility as well. And I would not, I mean, maybe the competition with Lean is a motivation to make it appear and but it's not a motivation to initiate the process at least.
Right. That makes sense. I think there's kind of this is an interesting thing about academic projects in general, is that we kind of there's a love-hate relationship with the fact that, you know, we can kind of do whatever we want whenever we want. And so, you know, if I want to put off, you know, some kind of basic programming features, I want to focus on some like really interesting technical problem of type theory, I can do that. And so there's kind of a point in these large software projects that came out of academia where we start to feel guilty, I guess, of just, you know, keeping things academic, and we want to start kind of helping these kind of industrial users and stuff like that. But I guess we also kind of help ourselves, right? Like when we make, you know, something like Rock more usable, we're also helping researchers who are getting on board and for the first time. And that's probably a lot of the motivation for that as well, right? It's not just kind of pressure from industrial users, it's also pressure to try to help the new users as well.
Yeah, maybe I said industry in a too strong sense. So any users are important, and we also have colleagues that have built all of their career on the Rock Prover, for instance, by formalizing everything in Rock on real numbers and everything. And if today we kind of do a new version that breaks everything there, they have the choice of either investing a lot of time trying to kind of fill the gap between the two versions, as what has been done with Matlib from Lean 3 to Lean 4. But it's okay for a whole community, but if we are talking only about the work of three or four researchers, then asking them to redo their 15 years of research on the new version is not really nice. And so we also have the responsibility to make evolution in their work also possible. So it's not only about industrial user, but about huge user in general. If it's only one local project of 100 lines, we don't it's not really important, but it's a huge library that has been developed in 10 years and so on. Then we have the responsibility to make it at least compatible with the new version.
And in the past, Rock has versions would often break proofs. Is that right? Like, I might be thinking of something else.
So it depends on what you mean with the past. So I think the one of the most breaking changes has been 8.0, but it's like very old now. It's okay. In the 90s. So I would say that since 15 years, we are very careful about that at least.
Okay.
Even if it doesn't mean that nothing breaks. So what we have now is a CI. So we didn't have at the time the CI. So we were just careful. Now we have a big CI of all the projects that are officially in the Rock ecosystem. And here we, even if we sometimes break a bit libraries or project on the CI, we fix the changes with the developer of the library. So if it's very easy, we just do a pull request on their GitHub repo and we fix it. If it requires a bit of work, we negotiate with them like we need to modify this and this and this. Can you give it in the coming months and so on. So we try to keep synchronized the whole CI with the new evolution of Rock. Mm. And if you're not part of the CI, then you are a bit outside of the radar, but the CI is very big. So if you want to be in the CI, you just ask. And most of the time we just integrate people. So mm.
Is Rock generally pretty good at dealing? Like I'm not like an active Rock user. Is it pretty good at dealing with kind of issues of like version bumps and stuff like that? Like maybe, I mean, in terms of the language, you're saying that it generally does support it, but I'm saying if I depend on a particular package and that particular package has had a version bump, is that an issue that's more or less
dependencies between libraries and stuff?
Yeah, that's what I mean actually.
We are relying on the OPAM package manager, which is developed mainly for OCaml.
Yeah.
So for the OCaml ecosystem, which is even I think bigger than the Rock one, and we are using the same package manager that with dependencies and so on. So it's quite stable and it's quite easy to install versions that are compatible with the current library that you're using and with the Rock version that you're using and so on. So it's really a package manager, okay, as you have for Linux ecosystem or this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I was thinking when I was an undergrad, this thing in the JavaScript ecosystem happened. It was the left pad incident, where a particular package had been, I think that was like five lines of code or something like that, had been taken off the package registry, or it had been modified in some kind of way, and it broke like huge amounts of things downstream. And I was thinking that like maybe dependent types would somehow like be able to kind of prevent these kinds of weird issues, because you know, yeah, okay, we're working on it.
And how did you guys choose the new name?
So the name has been chosen. So we made some kind of public request for new names, like people were able to propose any names, and then we did a poll on the Rock community. That has been advertised on the mailing list, which was called Cock Club at the time, but still exists. And so it's you can see it on the rockprover.org website. We have a page explaining the old name, the new name, and there is a link to the event to the whole pool and how many people vote for one name or the other. And I think even in the end, we decided to choose the name that was the higher amount of vote. I don't remember. I can check. Of votes, yeah. It's you have on the name evolution. You can see it on the page, and the we have even the kind of explanation of who has been voting, are they Cock user or not, where do they come from, Europe and the US and so on. And we have the result of there is also we first asked to the community whether they want the name change, because before changing a new name, the first thing was to decide whether we want to move or not, and also the reason why they want to change the name. And then once it has been clear that the majority was for the name changing, then we did a vote on the new name.
It's really interesting to see this thread. I haven't seen this before, the cock renaming thread. And you can see the breakdown of like men, women, Anglophone locations. The really significant one, actually, it's interesting. The people in Anglophone locations were very in favor of renaming it. And then folks from other locations, non-Anglophone locations, were majority not in favor.
Not, but not necessarily just France, French speakers.
Yeah, not even just necessarily French speakers.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
No, it's just people for which the word cock was not an issue in daily life speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, we have this similar situation in France. There is what is called BIT in computer science.
What is
like
that?
32 bits and like...
Oh,
And that's the French word for cock. So we have the exact opposite situation.
And there's no chance that the US
no, there is no way
gonna make any changes for you guys. I'm so sorry.
I didn't know.
We're used to it. I mean, it's since a long time, but
so this was the comeback, right? that's funny.
But in the first year undergraduate student, you always have to find, or maybe a bit less now because the student knows the word before they
right. enter
university. But 30 years ago, when they kind of discovered the word when they're doing their first lecture on computer science, it was a bit hard.
And that's so much bigger. Oh, God. okay, and what does rock mean actually?
So as we explained on the website, the original rock name was proposed because it's the short name for Rocancourt, which is the first INRIA physical site near Paris. So initially there were only one INRIA center. Now there are several of them in France, and the only one was in Rocancourt, and that's where the Cock Proof Assistant has been developed first by Gérard Ruet and Thierry Coquin. So it's kind of tribute to this original historical INRIA center. And it also means rock solid, so it's kind of the proof assistant on which you can rely on. And it has also a connection to music that we like. And it's also a lot of new play work that we can do with our research paper and so on with rock. So it's easy to do play work.
And so our community is all in for that, you know. Get.
Yeah. So we had the new cock, what used to be called cock and user developer workshop, where we kind of try to put in the same place rock developer and rock user and interact. It's now called Rock and Share. So,
oh, yeah, cool! A lot of, yeah.
So it's easy to build new names out of rock. So
nice, cool. What do you see the state of rock in 2025? You know, like what has happened this last say 5-10 years, and what do you see coming ahead for the future?
So what I mentioned this already, but I think we need to work on making different theorem provers more compatible in both on the kind of fundamental line, so with the sort polymorphism and everything, trying to make them compatible on a logical point of view, but mainly also on the user point of view, like translation between libraries from one prover to another. At some point, we need to do that, because otherwise it's a bit of a weird situation in which you say, oh, many theorem of mathematics have been formalized in Proof Assistant, but because they are not compatible, you cannot really mix this formalization. So what has been formalized with MathComp cannot be used directly in Lean. And if you want to use the ComCert compiler to do something else, if you want to do it in Lean, you kind of have to redo everything from the beginning. It's a bit weird. I mean, the situation is like, when we talk abstractly about formalization, we think about as if we are only using one single system, but in practice we don't. We are using several systems. We are using F-Star, Agda, and mainly Lynn Rock and Isabel and everything. And there is no clear way and clean way to connect that. And one of the reasons is that it's also based on language decision, design and stuff. So it's a huge engineering effort to do that. And my belief is that it will be a good use of modern AI and LLM stuff and generative AI to make use of these tools in order to get translator between Proof Assistant without doing it symbolically exactly, because even doing a parser, writing a parser for Lynn and Rock is already a very complex task. So writing a translation is even worse. And with LLMs, it seems that based on our first experiment, we don't have to deal with that. And as you said, you can code without understanding the language exactly. You can translate without understanding the exact syntax of everything. And because in the end it's type checked, you still have the guarantee that up to some alignment between the statements, at least you're not proving something that is not true. The worst thing that it would be that you're proving something that is not meaningful, but so that's one big thing. And then maybe trying to make more people able to contribute on the development also, because we are facing some kind of human power limitation, at least for the rock development. And I think what we see with communities building on big libraries and so on, it works when using the Proof Assistant, but it would be nice also to be able to build a community of people contributing in the development of the Proof Assistant itself, the engineering effort task. If they want a new feature, if we make it easy to contribute, then they can just implement this new feature, maybe with some discipline with the main core development team. But building the new, I think we have many users that have very good implementation skills on other programming language. When they want to formalize some programming language, it's because they know the programming language already and they have very good skills in development, and they could even contribute better. And VS Code, so now Lean and Rock are both using VS Code as the main front end. And then you need some, if you want new facilities with VS Code, I mean, it's completely orthogonal. It's very important, but orthogonal to the development of the kernel and everything. So we need many contributions on many different sides. And by making better advertisement and better structure on GitHub and so on, being able to accept many contributions here will kind of leverage a bit more the speed of development, because for now it's a bit limited by the human power.
You were talking about wanting like more contributions. Are there specific like big milestones over the next 5 years that you're thinking of in particular?
So specifically for the Rock Prover, we still have difficulties in having a full VS Code, very nice interaction. We also need to integrate it with AI stuff. So as Lynn is already a bit doing, like interfacing with ChatGPT or even Copilot or this kind of stuff, you can get explanation. So, for example, the documentation is very time consuming if you want to make it good, and because it's very time consuming, it's not updated as it should be, and so on. So it becomes kind of deprecated, and it's hard to find the information. And from what I see, we can use AI in order to build kind of dynamically the documentation on your thing based on Stack Overflow, whatever explanation and so on. It's kind of putting the kind of best union of what people are saying about the tools in order to get some kind of general documentation about one tactics or about one theorem and so on. And so having a nice integration here, it speed up the way you learn the language a lot, because you get the right information up front instead of trying to find something on GitHub or on Google or whatever. So I think the entry ticket the for a new user should be lowered a lot by investing more time in both the front-end user interface and integration with more LLM-based stuff in order to get documentation, because a very bare-bone documentation, as we are doing currently, it's good when you already know the system, because you know that something exists and you're able to find it back. But if you don't even know that it exists, you're not able to find it in the first place. So this kind of tools, because then from a usable point of view, I think both Lean and Rock are quite mature now, so they can be improved, but it will not make a big difference from a new user compared to a much more easy to grab with system.
So what comes to my mind when you talk about introducing new people to assist development of the tool? I think of two things. The first one is that Rock is extremely complex. You know, like the compiler, the type checker is a beast that people really avoid to touch, because, you know, like any little variable change there can lead to inconsistency really quick, for example, right? And so it's hard to get ourselves started, right? And the second thing is, okay, but how can we, could we as a community invest into welcoming, having a better way of welcoming new people, new developers, you know, in some sense. And what I see a lot in the Lean side is that they have a very strong institution injecting money, like actually hiring not only developers, but whole PR team kind of thing. And they're hiring David Christiansen to just write the book, for example, right? So there is money flowing. So I think this is one question I was meant to ask earlier when we were talking about, you know, like the institution around Rock. But you mentioned that you have Rock Consortium, right? Like that you can receive money from companies. Is that so? That's most okay. So most of the developers of Rock, you guys are researchers, mostly in India, right? And then there is some money flowing from the consortium. Is that the idea?
Yeah, but in practice, it's very low compared to the money we need. So even the engineers, they are employed by INRIA directly, and there is a bit of money coming from the consortium, but it's not even enough, because it's quite hard to mix academic institution in France and money coming from from abroad and industry.
Well, I think to wrap things up, I would like to ask, you know, like, what would you say to newcom researchers inspired to do work in type theory and in interactive theorem provers, but, you know, like, can be really intimidating by how complex and how high the bar is to even get started. You know, like, your personal reflection on your career, on where you're headed, and like, what would you say to new people or to your younger self even?
I think It's more a matter of motivation and having a nice project to start with. So at least for me, it worked quite well. So I mentioned the compiler thing I did with Nick Benton at Microsoft at the time. I think I would have gave up if I started just saying, let's say I will learn Cork without any specific purpose. It's kind of a big beast, and you don't know from where to start, and you can get discouraged quite quickly. But if you start from a real interesting, something that motivates you, a real use case, then you don't necessarily learn everything you have to know about the system, but you learn what you need to kind of progress on your, on your problem. And then it's easy to grab new features and a new way of using the system once you start using it. So you need to bootstrap for me on a specific project. So that's what I think worked quite well with the MATLAB community with Lean, is that people didn't start learning Lean out of thin air, but they start with the motivation of contributing to Lean, formalizing this specific part of some book or this specific theorem. So then you just understand the part of the library you need to look at in order to contribute, and you kind of emulate a bit what you have seen and try to do it on your new project, and one after the other you become a bit more expert about this, and then you can even give advice to other people and so on. But you start from a concrete and feasible project instead of just say I will learn the thing as a as an abstract notion, because then you don't know where to start. You don't really measure the progress you made, because it's hard to, and so it's easy to get discouraged. And so for the Rock Proof Assistant, you have the Software Foundation book of Benjamin Pierce and others, which is a nice thing to start learning, but it's still not very, to me, it's less motivating that starting on your own project that doesn't exist yet, because completing exercises that are already completed, it's not that fun. And now even with LLMs, you can just ask the solution to ChatGPT and it knows it already, because it's already on GitHub somewhere. So yeah, you get the solution. So you say, what's the point of learning something that is already there? So trying to define, to do something new, but not too difficult, is really more motivating to me. And even more since 4 years that you get everything from the web with some kind of artificial thing telling it for you. So,
how do you find yourself like onboarding like PhD students into the work? Do you find that they the ones who are kind of drawn to your group, they tend to already have all the expertise in the world, or do you have to kind of recommend they go through maybe not software foundations, but certain kind of foundational papers?
Yes, yeah, so some of my PhD students, most of them, they already know the Rock Prover, and sometimes now younger people, they know both Lean and Rock, or mainly Lean. But I also have PhD students that comes from mathematics and have been disappointed a bit by the lack of rigorousness of today's proof in complex area, where even if you ask to a researcher, why is it true this property, it's not really able to answer, because everything is a bit blurry, and say, everybody knows it's true, so just take it for granted. And so they come from this kind of algebraic topology or this kind of field where proof is very complex. And then I had to give them some book to learn, but most of the time I kind of recommend like the Hot Book, which is a book about homotopy type theory, which has been written quite recently, even it's now 10 years old, but with the idea of both learning type theory to mathematicians and computer scientists on step by step, not starting with univalence directly, but learning the basics of type theory and so on. So the book is quite pedagogical, but that's more from the theoretical side. And then if it's really using the Rock Prover, Software Foundation is still the best and one of the best entry point for the Rock Prover, at least. And in Lean, I think there is the natural number gain of this kind of stuff to start playing with Lean, but then it seems to me that most of the users start looking at Matlib. And
well, so with that, I am very glad that we got to have this conversation. Thank you so much, Nicola, for coming here, and thank you, Dan, for waking up super early too for being here. I really appreciate you, man. So yeah,
thank you for inviting me.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode as much as I did recording it. It's always a great pleasure for me to talk with Cock developers. As I've mentioned in the episode, Cock was my first functional programming language. And I don't know, I felt in love with it ever since, and I've been using it for more than 10 years now. So being closer to these people, it's always nice. It's always good conversations, and really appreciate the work they do. And it's very, very different kind of work that is done in the US. So it really changes perspective in many ways. But yeah, well, yeah, I'm pretty happy to have this conversation. I'm pretty happy with the renaming. It was more than time to make that happen. And I'm sure that was a lot of work for the developers to make it happen. So really, really appreciate their efforts and the work they've put into it. Now, another piece of news that I have for you guys that I finally have the domain email, so you can reach us on contact@typetheoryforall.com now. So send your emails over there. In the website, we also have a form that you can submit inquiries, questions, suggestions. Don't forget to check our Ko-fi, ko-fi.com/typetheoryforall, and submit any donations that you can. Will really help with the show. As I've mentioned the previous episode, I finally pulled the trigger, and I'm now working full time in this podcast because I genuinely believe that we don't have enough content being made in type theory, and we don't have enough content being made in formal methods, programming languages kind of research. So I'm working pretty hard to fill that gap a little bit and to produce more stuff for you guys. So there was a lot of work to make this marketplace happen. So if you guys can go there and buy anything, it will really, really assist and help the growth of the show and the continuation of this show going forward. So if you appreciate what we're doing, please consider spending a little bit of time. If you do not have any financial resources, one little thing that you can do that will really, really help us at this moment is to go to our YouTube channel and subscribe over there. That we now have, I'm doing these recordings with videos now. I don't know if you're watching the video version or the audio version. I will try to keep the podcast as audible as possible. I'm still, the focus is still to have a podcast, which is audio. But, you know, having video is nice. And also will allow us to make little cuts for social media, you know, like make things a little more digestible, because I know that long formats interviews are hard to digest sometimes. We are all busy people. We don't have time to do that. So I can do cuts and have these little key moments to share with everyone with the cool things that we are doing here. So if you can go to YouTube and assist our growth, it will be of a great, great assistance for us. I think that's it. Did I forget anything? Yeah. Follow us on Spotify, on Apple, whatever you watch the podcast. Leave a comment, leave a thumbs up. Help us with the growth stuff. See you guys next time. Keep yourself healthy. Healthy. Not healthy.